Why not?
Okay.
Are we ready to begin?
Yep.
Sure.
We're happy to do so.
All right, thank you very much. This is the virtual Zoom meeting of the Newcastle County Council Executive Committee meeting. I'll begin with the roll call. Councilman Bell?
Here.
Councilman Carter?
Here.
Councilman Cartier?
Here.
Councilwoman Diller?
Here.
Councilwoman Durham?
Here.
Council President Karen Hartley-Nagel? Councilwoman Kilpatrick?
Here.
Councilman Sheldon?
Here.
Councilman Smiley?
Here.
Councilman Street?
Here.
Councilman Tackett?
Here.
Councilman Woods?
Here.
And I'm Penrose Hollins. My legislative assistant, Nakai Trailer, will be taking the minutes for this meeting. The record will reflect at this time that the only council member absent is the president, President Karen Hartley-Nagel. Given that what is going on in the country over the last couple of weeks, I would ask council members if they would be kind enough to join me as we speak in this very moment. The funeral for George Floyd is being held in Houston, Texas. So I would like to ask for a moment of silence, please. Thank you all very much. I would ask for approval of the minutes from the Executive Committee meeting of May 19.
Motion to approve is provided.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Minutes from the meeting of May 19 are adopted. We'll move on to the first item of the agenda. Well, the next three items will be related to a phased reentry to our offices downtown. I think we all know what the goal is of Newcastle County government, and that is to mitigate the virus, to try to get back to work, and to also try to prevent the virus from coming back. So it's in that spirit that I decided, along with Clerk of Council Nellie and Council of Council Mike McGlure, to start planning for the reentry to downtown. And as everyone here knows, that the reentry to downtown is not a given. There's no certain dates. We don't know which way the virus may go. But we do need to plan. The plan is not to necessarily be away from the office forever. The plan is to at some point return. But as you know, a lot of that is out of our hands. So what you have, hopefully, it was sent electronically, an outline of how I'm prepared to have us re-enter. It's a very phased approach to re-entering downtown. And what I've done, I've looked at other governments, especially ours, looked at what's going on, and also paying very close attention to the comments coming from Governor Carney. So, Governor Carney, when you see the first part of what I mailed out in phase two, which Governor Carney plans to start on June 15th, phase two, restaurants and other businesses may expand to 60% of state bar occupancy with fitness centers and personal care facilities at 30%. Child care facilities will be allowed to open for all Delaware families. Indoor gatherings of up to 50 people will be permitted with appropriate social distancing, health and safety protocols established for the Wilmington office. And what that means is that the Clerk of Council, Nellie Mandelove, has been working for several weeks now, if not a month or so, to start ordering the PPE equipment and other protocols that we've discussed when we're able to get back into the building so we can continue to have a very safe environment and protect our personnel. Nellie will be talking about that on the third item of the agenda. Before Nellie speaks, Melora, Council to Council, will talk about potential legal concerns and going back into the building. On June 22nd, which is a week after the governor begins phase two, our Wilmington offices will open with limited staffing, requiring staff to work from Wilmington office one day a week, which means that the 4 days that our Wilmington offices are open, we would have at least two or three, maybe four of our staff people in the office. Again, Tuesday will remain work from home. We want to avoid having all of us in the office at the same time, staff and council members. So if we start a soft opening on the 22nd and with all of our staff being able to work one day a week, we could achieve the idea of having a soft opening every day with not everyone in the office on every single day, and also still have the Tuesdays set aside for when we're most busy and use this platform that we're on now. The public access to the Wilmington office will be permitted, but the permission will be only by appointment through a member of council who may want to meet with someone in the office to take care of some business. If that is the case, the Reading conference room will also be available for use. But if anyone is going to use the Reading conference room, we will also have to abide by the appropriate social distancing. So those proposals will take place starting June 22nd. And I have here that Delaware will likely move to phase three, probably near the end of June. That's obviously not a given since no one knows which way the virus is going to go. But we need to be prepared in the event that it does, and also prepared in the event that it does not. That's just a guesstimate. So on June 29th, we will continue to work one day a week at the Wilmington office, and Tuesdays will also remain work from home day. We will continue the one day a week until such time as we see a difference in what's going on here. And so around June 16th, depending on those conditions, we will probably increase the number of days in the Wilmington office for our staff. Up until this point, we will all still be going into the office. All of our staff will only be going into the office one day a week. So that pretty much covers how we're going to phase into the Wilmington office. If there are any questions, I'm willing to answer those now. Are there any questions for me? Councilman Sheldon?
Yeah, I just want to go over the dates again, because I thought you said the last time was June 16th. I'm thinking you meant July 16th. June 22nd once a week, June 29th once a week, and then July 16th?
July 6th.
What was that again?
On July 6th, depending upon the conditions, meaning how we moved along with mitigating the virus and what the governor is saying and other conditions, that's a very fluid date because there's too many unknowns right now. But I'm considering that sometime in July, we will probably move from one day a week to increased staff in the Wilmington office. However, we will probably continue on the Zoom platform for all of our meetings.
Okay, so full staff report July's thereabouts, July 6th.
It hasn't been determined yet, Councilman, because of the fluidity of the situation, but I'm hoping that we will have the virus pretty much mitigated, at least flattened the curve out. So I think that it's smart for us to start thinking about going back, and that it won't be a sudden surprise to anyone that at some point in time we are preparing to phase in slowly. And it all depends upon, you know, where we are, what the governor has to say with the health experts here in the state of Delaware. But if everything goes well, at some time in July, we'll probably be increasing our staff downtown.
Okay, I just want to write the dates down. That's all.
Absolutely. And we have this written, and Nakai would be happy to email it to you again.
I probably got it somewhere. All right, thank you.
Okay, very well. Any further questions from members of council? Any question for? I'm sorry, go ahead.
You've got Councilman Cartier, Councilwoman Kilpatrick, and Councilwoman Diller.
Councilman Cartier?
Yes, Thank you, Councilman Hollins. I appreciate you beginning the effort to recolonize the Wilmington office. I have a couple of serious concerns. The Lewis Redding building, as we all know, is a mid-rise building. It is serviced by elevators. We cohabit that building with the City of Wilmington and the row offices. So in order to enter an elevator, it seems it would be a rather difficult way to try to maintain staff in the building and have people use elevators with any kind of usual amount of people in the elevator. So I have concerns about that. And also what the City of Wilmington and the row offices, what they're going to be doing so that we don't overcrowd the building and defeat the idea of social distancing. As you know, the other county buildings are low-rise buildings or single-story and more easily controlled from that standpoint. So I just wanted to know what your perspective might be on that.
Thank you, Councilman. As you may know, the elevators in the city-county building, the last time we were in the building, there was a limit of 3 people per elevator. So I'm certain that those particular standards will remain in place. We also have the option of having our people work stays the hours as we do already. And the fact that we only have one person going into, well, we have 2 or 3 people going in once a week. So we would also pay attention to what the other occupants in that building may or may not be doing. And we have the flexibility if there's an issue there. But right now, this is a plan to move in. And there's a lot of uncertainty, as I said. So I don't know what the row officers are doing, what they're not doing. I do know that even now, they do have someone in their offices. Most of our county buildings have someone in their offices. Most of our buildings at the government center, there are people there, but there's just a skeleton staffing there. So most of the people in the county are working one day a week already. The libraries are open now with just drive-up service, but people who work in libraries are actually back to work. They're just not allowing the public in. And I agree with you, the building is somewhat different than the other buildings that we have as a county government, but they're pretty consistent with most office buildings that we're aware of. So the idea is that we want to be prepared. We are a public body, we're part of the government. And the other thing, I don't want it to appear as though Newcastle County is a prima donna branch of government. So we would be paying attention to all the things that you're concerned about. And I know Nelly has also been in touch with the city to see what other protocols they're planning to implement. One of those, I don't know them all, but one of those is that everyone who enters that building will be subjected, will have to get their temperatures taken. But those are all good questions. I know as I read about this virus and someone else had mentioned about the virus getting to the ducts and so forth. But I think most experts agree that this virus does not move into the atmosphere from going into the ducts and those kinds of things. So there's a lot of material out there. Obviously, I'm not an expert, but I do think that we would take every practical precaution to make certain that people are safe. Anything further, Councilman Cartier?
Thank you.
Councilwoman Kilpatrick?
And thank you.
Councilman Hollins, you could add Council President Nagel and Councilman Bell to your list. They want to speak.
Thank you very much. Councilwoman Kilpatrick?
Yes, I have a couple of questions about how are we going to determine who is going in on what days of the week to make sure that we don't have a majority of the people in there. You know, if everybody decides that Monday or Thursday is their better day, then I'm sure that's not what you're looking for. I'm sure that you're looking for a person or two to be in rather than all of the staff. I have some concern about those that moving supplies back and forth. I mean, how cumbersome is that if they've been set up now for 6 or 8 weeks at home with their everything they need? Is that going to cause a problem with going back and forth, especially with the clerk and the deputy clerk? And I know that you said daycares are beginning to open. However, many people on staff would have started in February or March signing their children up for different camps, because after certain ages, you don't just go to daycare. They have not had the ability to do that at this point. And most of the camps at this point are not open or taking very few people if they are. So I think, you know, from the staff perspective, if we talk about the beginning of July, we're talking about being in second week in July, we're talking about them being in there for 4 weeks or so, and then we're off. So, and come back right around Labor Day, which is very late this year, but that's about when we come in. So, you know, is there a reason that maybe we wouldn't have the receptionist in to field phone calls or something like that? But how many other people at a time would be going into that building? Because as with Councilman Cartier, you know, there may only be three people on an elevator, but those elevators are not cleaned. Where you touch the door, where you touch the buttons, they are not cleaned after every run up and down. And we've got bathrooms that have to be considered.
Thank you very much, Councilwoman Kilpatrick. The staff will go in one day a week, as I mentioned. And Nellie and I, the clerk, have talked about her scheduling the staff as she normally does. So staff members will have an opportunity to select through the clerk which day they would like to go in. And the clerk would make certain that there's someone in the building every day, but it'll be only one person. As far as the camps are concerned, that issue has come up before in meetings I think you were involved with. And we had agreed that if there's a hardship for any of our staff, that we would make arrangements for those hardships. I mean, it happens all the time. We've made arrangements before, so I don't see any reason why that would be any different. I'm just telling you from what I read, it's what the governor is saying. So if we have specific hardships, obviously we're going to address those. In terms of moving, the hardship of moving the laptops, et cetera, I believe one of the primary reasons we have the laptops and we spent the expense of the laptops is to give us that mobility. So we're not moving computers, and I think for those council members who elected that the laptops would give them an opportunity to be more mobile, and that was the real reason for that. And it's all because of where we are now, and most of us who are getting laptops like myself just received it a few weeks ago to allow myself and my legislative assistant to be more mobile and be more efficient in that. But with all that being said, at some point we have to plan to go back into the office, and that's what I'm doing. And I don't think that I can ever guarantee, and anyone else can guarantee, that any and every facility is going to be sterilized so that there will be no potential of this virus. So I think that we can look at it two ways. We can be reasonable and try to phase in, or we can look for an absolute end of the virus, or we can wait for a vaccine to be created, or we can have people walking around with sanitizers. I don't know, but I think the practical thing to do at this juncture is to be on pace with most other businesses and most other governments, and that is to try to find a way to phase in. In terms of July, I said earlier, that is a fluid date because we don't know which way the virus may go, but that's very dependent upon that and what the governor has to say and the healthcare officials in the government. I don't think anyone, but I do follow the guidelines as we have done so far. It was the governor who declared the emergency in the first place, and it's the governor who's going to different phases. So I don't want us to be an outlier and have a different healthcare professionals pretty much telling us to be out of line with what the governor is proposing. So that's why we're taking the steps that we are. In terms of the vacation that council takes in August, I think it's important to try to be back into the office in some fashion before that vacation period. While the council is on vacation, the staff is not on vacation. Maybe some of them are, and I believe some of them do prefer to take their vacations in August as well. But we are public servants, we are in a public building, and at some point we have to be available to the public, and if other governments can figure it out, we will figure it out as well. Councilwoman Diller.
Yes, I just think, you know, as you said, we need to hold harmless. I'm a little worried about 2 weeks after you know, what we're going to be seeing, if we're going to see a spike after the holiday weekend. So we'll just wait and see. But I think the important thing is we need to stay flexible on this, you know, as you've said. But I must admit, I'm not real comfortable thinking about moving back in too quickly.
Thank you, Councilwoman Diller. And I understand that as well. And I know that we all have opinions. And I think some people would probably want to work from home until next year. In my opinion, Are
we voting on this?
No, we're not.
We are not voting on this.
No, we're not voting on this.
How interesting.
It's not very interesting if you were to look at our rules and you look at the role of the president, which right now I'm the president pro tem, in terms of staffing and those kind of issues. It's up to the president. This is not a policy issue. This is not a resolution. It's a decision being made by the acting president of the county council.
Councilman Hollins, would you add Councilman Carter to your list?
Yes. Councilman Diller, I'm sorry, any further question?
No.
Thank you. Councilman Bell?
Yes, I think President Hartley Nagel is right before me.
Is she next? Oh, I'm sorry, she is. President Hartley Nagel?
Yes, I want to address right now that procedurally, this is quite interesting in how this has been done. But to get to the root of what we're here and to discuss right now, I spoke with Nellie and I spoke with Mike, I spoke with some of the other council members, and had an ongoing conversation from the beginning when I took the initiative and we said, made sure that our employees were working from home as soon as we found out about the coronavirus and how it could affect our employees, and we certainly don't want any to get sick. With that being said, here we are, we still have the General Assembly is not going in because of the coronavirus. So looking at them, but also looking at how our council is set up, we don't have a lot of employees, we just have a few. Why would we ask any one of them to go in when they have to go up and down those elevators? I was just in there Friday. They are not sanitized. Other people are going in. You know, the employees would have to go in. They have children at home. They take care of their elder, some or their elderly parents. And to place them in that situation when we don't have to. I've spoken to the three of the row offices. They only have the essential personnel going in that they had to keep their offices running. Our office is running great. So why would we haven't had any problems. Why would we change anything yet when we are in the unique position to do it a little differently, to take precautions for our employees? We're not closed. Our constituents are reaching the aides, the council people. We're able to hold our meetings and all of us be safe. We want to be safe at least through July, mid-July, like the governor has said, but also to reevaluate then and see, do we want to continue through August, which I think would be prudent. Because there is no rush. There's nobody telling us we have to open. There's nothing critical that we're not doing right now or that we could do better in the office because we've got a great staff and a great team. And they are doing an awesome job. And I hear it from constituents. So I don't want to place even one of our employees at risk of getting the coronavirus because we don't know enough about it. We don't know enough if it can be transmitted through the ventilation system that's recirculated in our offices. You know, and then we have Friday, as I was there at the protest, we also have barriers that are all around the city county building. You can't get in unless you come up through the garage or about a 1.5 foot little spot in the back in order to get in. You know, they have at the front desk, you know, the riot rock that's labeled riot rock with the date where that rock went through the window. Almost 2 weeks ago now. So, you know, there's many considerations that we need to consider before we bring our employees in. And once again, I will say there is nothing critical that has to be done in the office versus working remotely.
Thank you, Madam President. I don't consider this a rush into the office. I think I'm phasing into the office. And we will monitor what's going on around us and around the entire state. As far as the General Assembly is concerned, in my opinion, they've always been an outlier. They always create rules for everyone else that they don't follow themselves. I don't think they're a good example, but in this case, I have all of the fears that you mentioned. I think we all do. But I also think we have to be practical here to suggest that somehow we're being exposed unnecessarily or overwhelmingly. This is not a sanitized society that we live in. So the reason we're taking these protocols and we're phasing as we are, and we're not having any dates set in stone because we don't know. I think Councilman Dillon said it may come back. Well, it may. Do you think if it comes back, anyone is going to continue down the path that we're trying to get to now? No. That's just not a practical position to be in. But there's great respect for what's going on now. And you mentioned the air in the ducts and so forth. As I just mentioned to Councilman Cartier, the virus is not spread that way. That's what the experts are saying. So in my opinion, you can have a reason not to go into the office for the next 6 months. And that's just, in my opinion, it's just not realistic. It's not practical. And we should be thinking more about finding safe ways to re-enter the office. We have have our staff working one day a week for 2 or 3 weeks. We can stagger the time that the staff go in. We're fortunate that in our offices, unlike so many other offices, it's one person per office. So there are no pools in our office. There's no excessive barriers we need to put up. Everybody works in an office to themselves. And quite frankly, if you were to go into our office on any day other than Tuesday, it's almost hard to find anybody. So the notion that our office is going to be crowded because we have staff people going in one day a week, I'm just not convinced that's the case. But thank you for your considerations and concerns. Councilman Bell.
Thank you, Mr. President Pro Tem. You know, I listen, and I think that when we take a look at Newcastle County Council, we are the example. We're the ones that have led the way from day one with COVID-19. I applaud and commend Councilman Carter, working with Nelly and with Tara, all of our legislative aides. I think we've all learned very well to adapt to being able to utilize today's technology. We haven't missed a beat. This council has still stayed open, transparent, consistent in what our applications and what our representation of government is. And unlike our counterparts throughout the state, this government has set the example from day one. I certainly respect and understand that we've got to take a look at the future and at what point do we start to phase back in. But in all honesty, I'd have to agree with Councilwoman Kilpatrick. I mean, I think that these next couple summer months, we're right back in the thick of things. You have folks that take vacation. You have some time that we're off. The technology is already in place. And our offices have operated, I think, very admirably. Our leadership from the standpoint of our clerk and deputy clerk, everyone involved, I think, has done a tremendous job. And in all honesty, I don't really feel, unless it's a mandate, unless it's something legal that says that we have to do it, I personally don't think that we're ready yet. I think that the way we have things set up right now works. I'm not professing for 1 minute that we continue this forever, but I can tell you that I think a lot of other governments, agencies, departments in the county have learned from the example and the method of operation that this council has operated. And I thank Dave Carter. I thank our staff and everyone. So I'm not in any hurry to support getting our folks back in the office yet.
Thank you, Councilman Bell. Again, I say this is not a rush. It's not a hurry. I would agree with you that it has worked very well. I believe we were the first to start on the Zoom platform before the other governments did. At some point, the plan is to go back into the office, and that's what I'm presenting here today. And I can understand the pushback, but that's my position, is that we will start a one day a week, like many others in Newcastle County are doing currently. And as I said also, that it's fluid. I did not say that in July that we were going to have the full staff going back in. What I did say is that it would be contingent upon where the virus is and which way it's going. And quite frankly, I don't think any of us really know. And if it's going in a direction that I think we all going to know that it's unsafe, but to impress upon me today that saying that as we move into phase two, that it's going to be detrimental to the health of our staff to have people going there one day a week, to me, it's just a little bit out of reality. So, but I appreciate your comments. Councilman Carter?
I appreciate the efforts to go back. I don't think we should extend it for 6 months, but as I think all of you know, almost to nauseam, I'm often driven by data. And, you know, to me, the data isn't there yet, but it will be very soon. What we are experiencing because of the compromise that needs to be made for some of our businesses that just cannot survive much longer, we are taking a little bit of a risk there. They're opening up. I don't see the essential elements of what's not being done by council to drive us. The governor's allowing them to open up. He's not requiring it. You know, we are now getting wonderful mailings. We are voting on authorization for funding for more testing tonight. For the first time, we are actually asking people to go out, even if they're non-symptomatic. These are critical, critical pieces of data that we are about a month and a half to 2 months from having in our hands. That data will really, really tell us an order of magnitude more about what's going on than we know right now. So jumping in front of that, I think we are moving a little bit quicker. I actually think to take that extra month and then have that period in August to really work this out with that data in hand that we know, and we'll be able to see the models and predictions of what can happen. We have other things going on. I mean, I'll get tested on Friday. We're seeing some major issues and energies in this country. I was out at 3 protein test events. I know I put myself at a risk. I'll get tested on Friday. I personally am happy to come in one day a week. I can cover for other staff. I don't care. I can answer phones because I'm willing to, I'm taking that risk anyway. But I think we should really look at the fact that we are funding, we are getting this data. We will have that, I think, in about 6 to 8 weeks. It looks like they're turning that test around pretty quick. Even if we get through the data analysis of that sheet that we just sent out to our constituents of what we're having testing, it will tell us way more than we know now about the prevalence out there. And I just urge us, knowing that we're funding that data, that we're getting that data. I understand the business need to open up. I support them. I don't know, you know, for me, if they're going to be a high enough urgency for me to go out and sit in restaurants yet. But I would urge us all to look at this plan and shift it, maybe even expedite it a little bit after August when we really have the data in hands. You know, in public health issues, I think getting the data is really important, and it's coming.
Thank you, Councilman Carter. And by all means, I appreciate the scientific background and the data that you're able to actually understand and recommend on a lot of different issues. But on this issue, it's not necessarily a scientist that's on county council or any other council. The data that I read, and I'm not the scientist that you are, said this is very complicated, even from scientists that are in the national level to try to determine what's going on. As you know, what's going on in Delaware is not necessarily what's going on in Mississippi. So it's an unknown, and that's why we're taking the time that we are. But I don't believe there's going to be an absolute, even at the date that you're saying that you know you know better, and maybe you will, but the data I'm reading, and just read it 2 days ago, about the challenge of this virus and how it basically travels and so forth. So I appreciate what you're saying, but it seems to me that there's a number of people who would prefer the plan to stay out than the plan to go back. And I think that a reasonable approach to go back, and it's not etched in stone, it's not an indictment on how we've been doing so far. I believe that we've done a great job in terms of how our responses has been with our meetings, and today is no exception. But to suggest that I'm saying that this is broke, that's not the case at all. What I'm saying is that the plan is that we should be planning to phase back into our offices. Thank you for your comments. Councilman Carter, I think you're the last person.
Council President.
President Hartley-Nagel.
And you have George.
Yes. I just wanted to bring your attention. You don't have to be a scientist to look at the paper and see the numbers and how many are getting sick, how many are still dying, how many new people have the coronavirus. So I don't see why we would rush, and it does feel like we're rushing because we don't have data to support that there is a lessening so far of the virus spread. And we also don't know as their businesses are opening up, if we're going to see new cases. Now, I totally understand why the governor would open up the state. He needs to, economically, certain businesses, they're having a very rough time. So you have to do that, but we're not selling anything. We're not making money. We're going to potentially put our employees at risk. But why? For what? For something that they're already doing a great job at, working remotely, that there's no downtime, that all calls are being answered. All calls that are coming into the council are forwarded to their cell phone or my cell phone or their home phone. So there really is not.
Are you forgetting I'm also a member of council?
Excuse me?
Are you forgetting I'm also a member of council? I understand what's going on now.
Well, I'm not jumping to a conclusion that all council members have their calls forwarded to their cell phone. It may be their home phone. That's what I was correcting.
Well, thank you. Maybe now they'll be able to take advantage of the opportunity if they haven't done so far. But I have, as well as my legislative assistant. And honestly, you're sort of regurgitating some of the things you've said already. The fact of the matter is we're going to try to make the environment as safe as we possibly can. We're going to be very reasonable about going back. All of us are doing other things other than being at home doing the government's work. We all are going to a supermarket somewhere. We're all going to get some gas every now and then. We all are being exposed to some degree. But to say if you go into the office one day a week, it's going to tremendously overwhelm you. So you're going to be more likely to get this virus. To me, it's just getting to be a little bit ridiculous. So let's plan to phase in as we're doing. There's no indictment on what we're doing now. And to suggest that every other person is not going back, it's just not right. I didn't mention the grocery stores, anything like that. That's not relevant here. I'm saying other governments, including Newcastle County government, one day a week, folk. So a person going in the building downtown one day a week is going to automatically be exposed. This person doesn't go any place at no time, but going downtown one day a week is going to dramatically increase the potential of them getting the virus. That just doesn't make common sense. Well, we can have further discussion, but we have a lot of other things on the agenda.
I'm not surprised that you're cutting it off.
Well, I want to move on. If you look at what time it is, to get through the other parts of the agenda, and we can continue this conversation later. And as you know, there's a 4 o'clock meeting coming up with public safety. So I appreciate your comments, but we do need to move on to the next agenda item.
You have Mr. Woods and Mr. Smiley still with their hands up.
Okay, Mr. Woods, Councilman Woods.
Yes. So just in my 2 cents for this, construction, we've never stopped working since this virus took place. I have over 2,000 members working between Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. We've had one member come down with the COVID virus, one member out of 2,000 active people working every day out in the field. So I agree we need to be safe here. I like the phase-in method that you're doing here. I think it's the right way to go. But everybody has to get out and go to the grocery store, go to any other place they're going, getting their takeout and everything else. Eventually, we have to get back. And our taxpayers are asking why our people aren't back at this point. And I agree that, and I say to them the exact same thing, we're trying to keep our people safe, and this is how we're doing it. But the phase-in area that you've suggested, I think, is the right way to go. And I'm going to say this is a good job, and continue with that.
Thank you, Councilman Woods. Councilman Smiley? Councilman Smiley?
You're muted.
I'm muted?
I usually don't do that. My apologies. I'll try to be brief. I know some people probably figure, well, what's he got to say? He doesn't have a legislative aide. Well, I don't plan on having one until after we're back to as close to normal as we can. But I do want to say, this is tough for me, but I think I'm in kind of a unique situation just with the way I've always been. I haven't missed a beat, be it with the office, out with my constituents, or anything else. So I've tried to look at this in the broad picture for those that don't have the flexibility or the lack of concern that I have. I appreciate all the work that you put into this. I understand it. I'm kind of looking at, as was said earlier, you know, we're off almost all of August. We have a few meetings in July. There's vacation time there that people will be taking. I understand what the governor said. I tried to follow it, but it seems like every time he has put something out, it has also been followed with an urge that those that can continue to work from home do so, which will allow space to free up in daycares for those that don't have that flexibility and are required to go back to work. So I think that we should look at that as well. But one of the things I'm thinking, because over the past few weeks, month, I've had occasion to talk to some of the legislative aides, and maybe we want to take a look at whether voluntarily, are there aides that want to come into the office to work? I know I'd rather work from the office than home. I like the atmosphere, and I don't have my calls forward to my phone from the office. I just don't want people thinking I'm there when I'm not. But that's working for me. It's worked very well for me. But I think maybe we want to look at if there are aides that don't, like me, are flexible, don't have children, don't have older people to look after during the day. Maybe they want to. Maybe they want to come in and fill the void that you're talking about. But I do think, and I'm not trying to pick on anybody here, but the front desk is set with the plastic. It has been set up. The mail has been coming through in various ways. I do think that part of the way to begin to go back is to have the front office open. You can have the door closed, but have someone there to man the calls coming to council to pass on. We can do like the roll offices have the drop box outside for incoming mail, outgoing mail. Council members can have it mailed to them if they want. Some of the boxes have been overflowing. Council president had to take yours and put it in a box. There isn't any room anymore, but it is out there. So we have someone handling that. I think that is a big plus for what some council members have talked about with the public and having access. So that's my 2 cents worth. Again, I know I don't have an aide. I don't plan on bringing one until after the August break, possibly into September. I'm sure not interviewing people now with all this going on. So thank you.
Thank you, Councilman Smiley. As you know, I'm not talking about going back. I'm trying to go forward. Yep. I'm aware of how some of the other offices are operating now with the Dropbox, and they do have people there. But for the public, the Dropbox can be at the box. The city does a lot of the same type of work where the public has access, but there is an employee there that goes down to that Dropbox. So what I'm saying is that there are governments where people are already doing what I'm proposing to do in the future.
Well, Councilman Hollins, our mail actually can get delivered directly to our door, because it doesn't come from outside, it comes right from inside.
The other thing is that if Nelly, and we've talked about this, if Nelly can find the people that want to be in the office and people who don't, the concern I really have is that there's a fairness issue here. Some people may see working from home as a benefit, I don't know, but I can tell you from the lesson I learned when we were last sued, fairness was a major issue. Everybody wants to be treated equally. And to me, accountability is also an issue. So all of these things, it's nothing wrong with any of those things, but there are other things that we need to be concerned about as well as a government entity with employees working for this government. So I think a reasonable approach that I'm proposing here is the way to go. We can have further discussions, and it is flexible. But the fact of the matter is, I think if we were to take a poll, you know, we'd probably have 3 or 4 different
times to start or when to start or not to start. But we have to plan to move forward. And if the virus is going to take a turn, we all are going to know that. It's not privileged information. So we're going to know that. So I thank you all for your comments. And I think we're going to move on the agenda because Mike has quite a bit. And then Nelly will have an opportunity to talk about the protocols that we will be following. And then I do want to get to the point of the protests that are going on across America and across the universe today as we speak. So Mike, I'll give it to you.
Thank you, Councilman. Good afternoon, everyone. I know time is short and we've got a tight schedule today, so I'm going to do my best to keep this tight and hit the high notes. Obviously, I'll be available for anyone if you want to talk afterwards if we aren't able to address your question during this period. So what I'll be touching on is legal considerations related to returning to the workplace. The purpose of the presentation is to provide an overview of three key bodies of law that apply to the pandemic, which are namely the Americans with Disability, also known as the ADA, the new law, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, FFCRA, and Title VII. There are other laws that apply to a lesser degree. I'm not going to get into them for the sake of time today. And we'll discuss the three laws generally. I will not be discussing specific staff situations as they are personnel related and should be handled on a case-by-case basis. So moving to the memo that I provided to everyone yesterday, I've identified the symptoms that are routinely identified by the CDC. Very concerning with this disease, I think everyone knows at this point, is that list is not comprehensive. And it's evolving, and probably most concerning is the fact that many people are asymptomatic, and that number of asymptomatic individuals in the population ranges from 80% to some other number. The CDC has agreed that at least 35% are asymptomatic. So this emphasizes how important it is to wear proper PPE. Adhere to social distancing and other related protocol. And with that, moving to the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, the first topic there is disability-related inquiries and medical exams. An important starting point is how much information can an employer request from an employee who calls in sick in order to protect its full workforce? And the answer is during the pandemic, the ADA permits employers to ask employees if they are experiencing symptoms of the pandemic virus. The employer must, council and county government must maintain all information as a confidential medical record in compliance with the ADA. The other piece, now moving to screening, which is something we've talked about. The question is, when screening employees entering the workplace during the pandemic, may an employer only ask employees about the COVID-19 symptoms the EEOC has identified? And the answer is no, because of the fact that the symptoms are ever evolving. Moving from there, another relevant question, something we've discussed in the protocols that Nelly will get to, and that is, when may an employer take the body temperature of employees during the pandemic? And generally, a measuring of employees' body temperature is a medical examination. However, the CDC and the health authorities have acknowledged community spread of the pandemic COVID-19, and so they've allowed employers to measure employees' body temperature. Of course, that information needs to be maintained confidentially, however. When employees return to work, is there a specific procedure that the county or county council can require? And the answer is yes. It can require, for example, a doctor's note certifying fitness for duty. Moving on, may an employer administer a COVID-19 test I think that was mentioned earlier today and something that's been thought of, mentioned previously. May an employer administer a test before permitting employees to return to the to enter the workplace? And the answer is yes. But the employer should ensure that the tests are accurate and reliable. There are many tests out there. At least several months ago, they were questionable. So that's one thing absolutely that should be assured, the reliability of the test. Again, that information has to remain confidential. That's a good segue to the further discussion regarding the confidentiality of the medical information. And the medical information cannot be maintained as part of the personnel file. It should be maintained separately. If there's already an existing medical file, then COVID-related information can be placed in there. But the point is that the information should remain separate, both the personnel file and the medical file. If it's part of the scanning, if the employer requires all employees to have a daily temperature check before entering the workplace or during the work day, may the employer maintain a log of the results? And again, the answer is yes, it has to be maintained confidentially. And among other things, that can assist in contact tracing. Another question that has arisen is whether an employer can disclose the name of an employee to a public health agency when it learns that the employee has COVID-19. And the answer is yes, it can. Moving on to page 4, there we deal with the issue of reasonable accommodations, which the reasonable accommodation for an individual whose disability puts her or him at a greater risk from COVID-19. Such individuals have to request actions to eliminate possible exposure. Even with the constraints imposed by the pandemic, some accommodations may meet an employee's needs on a temporary basis without causing undue hardship, and that's the standard. Undue hardship as it applies to the employer, which means it's a significant difficulty or expense. And we'll get into that a little more in depth in a moment. If an employee has a pre-existing mental illness or disorder that has been exacerbated by COVID-19, may he or she now be entitled to reasonable accommodation? And the answer is yes, absent undue hardship. Although many people you hear are feeling more and more significant stress due to the pandemic, employees with certain pre-existing mental health conditions, for example, anxiety orders, OCD, et cetera, may have more difficulty handling the disruption. And as with any accommodation request, the employer may, as part of what's termed as an interactive process, ask questions to determine whether the condition is a disability. It should include a discussion with the employee how the requested accommodation will assist him or her to continue working. And they should explore alternative accommodations that may effectively meet their needs. And at times it may also require medical documentation. In a workplace where employees are required to telework during this time, should an employer postpone discussing a request from an employee with a disability for an accommodation that will not be needed until he or she returns to the workplace when mandatory telework ends? And the answer is no. Again, it's an interactive process, and it's best to be flexible, particularly in these uncertain times. So that can be addressed once an employee brings that to the attention of the employer. I'm trying to hit some of the high notes. I know we're short on time. During the pandemic, may an employer still engage in the interactive process and request information from an employee about why an accommodation is needed? Answer again is yes. If an employee brings that to our attention, then we should engage in that interactive process, flexible process, sooner rather than later. Moving to page 6, may an employer ask employees now if they will need reasonable accommodations in the future? Again, the answer is yes. There's not an obligation, but employers may ask employees with disabilities to request accommodations that they believe they may need when the workplace reopens. What types, now moving to the legal term undue hardship, so you can better understand what that means. What types of undue hardship considerations can be relevant to determine if the requested accommodation poses significant difficulty? That's the standard during the pandemic. And an employer may consider whether circumstances create significant difficulty in acquiring or providing certain accommodations, considering facts of the particular job and workplace. A good example of that is it may be significantly more difficult right now during the pandemic, although it seems to be on the tail end, to conduct a needs assessment or require certain items. I think that's still probably an issue as far as supply. And delivery may be impacted, particularly for employees who may be teleworking. What types of undue hardship considerations may be relevant to determine if a requested accommodation poses significant expense during the pandemic? And the answer is that prior to the pandemic, most accommodations would not satisfy the significant expense standard when considered against an employer's overall budget and resources. Obviously, with the sudden loss of some or all of employers' income stream due to the pandemic, that now has become more of a relevant consideration. But also part of that, also relevant, is the amount of discretionary funds available at the time, considering other expenses, and whether there's an expected date the current restrictions on the employer's operations will be lifted. Moving to page 7, now talking about pandemic-related harassment due to national origin, race, or other protected characteristics. With the pandemic emanating from China, there has unfortunately been what I would term as pandemic-related harassment based upon national origin. And one of the first points there is what practical tools are available to employers to reduce and address workplace harassment that may arise as a result of the pandemic? And as with the chance of any harassment, employers should be communicating to the workforce that fear of the COVID pandemic should not be misdirected against individuals because of a protected characteristic. And of course, it is best for the employer to remind all employees that it's against federal law to harass. Not only is it the wrong thing to do, but it's against the law to harass or otherwise discriminate against coworkers. Moving to the middle of page 7, return to work. As government stay-at-home orders and other restrictions are modified, how will employers know what steps they can take consistent with ADA to screen employees when entering the workplace? And the answer there is that the ADA permits employers to make disability-related inquiries and conduct medical exams if job-related and consistent with business necessity. Inquiries and reliable medical exams will meet that standard if it's necessary to exclude employees with a medical condition that would pose a direct threat to health or safety. And that's a term of art, direct threat, it's defined, and it is to be determined based upon the best available medical evidence. The guidance from CDC or other health authorities is such evidence, and therefore employers will be acting consistent with the ADA as long as any screening implemented is consistent with the advice of the CDC and other health authorities for that type of workplace at the time. Moving to page 7 and bleeding over to 8, an employer requires returning workers to wear personal protective gear and engage in infection control practices. Some employees ask for accommodations due to a need for modified protective gear. Must an employer grant these requests? And the answer is that an employer may require employees to wear protective gear, like we're considering, for example, masks and gloves, and observe infection control practices, for example, regular hand washing, social distancing, and the like. However, when an employee with a disability needs a related reasonable accommodation under the ADA, something like that may be for an individual who is allergic to latex gloves, for example. They may request non-latex gloves or modified face masks, or there may be others who communicate with an employee who uses lip reading, for example, or there could be a religious accommodation. So those are the types of accommodations that can be made. Moving on, what does an employee need to do in order to request reasonable accommodation because he or she has a medical condition? And the answer is an employee or a third party, could be their doctor, must let the employer know that she or he needs a change for a reason related to a medical condition. Here it might be an underlying condition. And the individuals may request the accommodation in a number of ways. It could be in conversation, could be in writing. And the employee does not need to use the magical term reasonable accommodation or reference the ADA, but may do so. But the employee ultimately should communicate that they have a medical condition that necessitates a change to meet that medical need. And after receiving that request, the employer may ask questions, in fact, should, it's part of the interactive process, to determine what kind of reasonable accommodation, barring any undue hardship, that can be provided. Moving to the middle of page 9, what are examples of accommodation that absent undue hardship may eliminate or reduce to an acceptable level a direct threat to self? And the answer is that accommodations may include additional or enhanced protective gowns, masks, gloves, or other gear beyond what the employer may generally provide to other employees returning to its workplace. Another possible reasonable accommodation may be elimination or substitution of what's termed as marginal functions, which are less critical or incidental job duties. In addition, accommodations may include temporary modification of work schedules, like we've talked about, if that decreases contact with coworkers and or the public when on duty, or it may mean moving location of or if someone works to a location where they're not going to come into contact with so many people. That's the summation of the ADA generally. Moving to the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which is also, you very well may have seen, it's the FFCRA. It's a brand new law Congress enacted in March of this year in response directly to the coronavirus. It requires employers to provide employees with paid sick leave or expanded family and medical leave for specified reasons related to COVID. It will be in effect, it started April 1 of this year and will be in effect currently through the end of the year. Moving to page 10, just giving a general overview of the FFCRA, it provides that employees are eligible for 2 weeks, up to 80 hours of paid sick leave at the employee's regular rate of pay, where the employee is unable to work because of a quarantine and or is experiencing COVID-19 symptoms and seeking a medical diagnosis, or 2 weeks up to 80 hours of paid sick leave at 2/3 of the employee's regular rate of pay because the employee is unable to work because of a bona fide need to care for an individual subject to the quarantine or to care for a child under 18 years of age. And up to an additional 10 weeks of paid expanded family and medical leave at 2/3 the employee's regular rate of pay, where the employee has been employed for at least 30 days and is unable to work due to a bona fide need for leave to care for a child whose school child care provider is closed. The eligible employees, as I briefly talked about, it's all employees of covered employers. They're eligible for 2 weeks of paid sick time for specified reasons related to COVID. The qualifying reasons for leave, now at the bottom of page 10, there are 6 in particular that have been cited under the FFCRA, and an employee qualifies for paid sick time if the employee is unable to work or unable to telework due to a need for leave because the employee one is subject to a quarantine that's related to COVID-19. Secondly, has been advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine as a result of COVID. Three, they're experiencing COVID-19 symptoms. And these are all in the alternative. One of these will suffice. And is seeking a medical diagnosis. Four, is caring for an individual subject to self-quarantine, or quarantine order rather, or self-quarantine, as noted above. Five, is caring for a child whose school or place of care is closed or unavailable as a result of COVID. Or number six, is experiencing any other substantially similar conditions identified by Health and Human Services. The duration of the leave for the reasons noted one through four, primarily pertaining to quarantine or self-quarantine, the duration of leave for a full-time employee is eligible for 80 hours of leave, and a part-time employee is eligible for the number of hours of leave that they work on an average over a two-week period. For reason five, where the employee is caring for a child whose school or place of care is closed or unavailable, full-time employee is eligible for up to 12 weeks of leave and 2 weeks of paid sick leave. It breaks down to 2 weeks of paid sick leave followed by up to 10 weeks of paid expanded family and medical leave. For those interested and want to drill down further, the calculation of pay is identified on page 11, the formula to get there. And with that, I finished with the FFCRA. The next two laws I'll just touch on very generally that are applicable here. And number one, it's Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination based upon race, color, national origin, religion, and gender. And then the other law to consider is Age Discrimination Employment Act, which prohibits discrimination based on age 40 or older. Now that could come into play with the fact that under COVID, individuals, I believe 60 or older, have been identified as more susceptible to the COVID pandemic and the disease. So that has to be something taken into account and reconciled with the bottom line, need to be treated in a like manner. And then finally, other considerations, of course, is Governor Carney's general guidance, phase one, which became effective June 1, which provides certain guidance that we talked about generally before. And I believe that'll be in place for, I believe, another week or so. And finally, a thought is to have the administration of the HR requirements here under the laws that I identified to be performed by the HR department in conjunction with council and the processes that HR has created, for example, the personnel policy 3.24. And then with that, Ignelli will take it here to discuss steps to contain the risk of the disease by implementing certain protocol. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. I'm going to ask the cooperation of council members. Staff and council members did receive this report from you today. I believe that a number of council members as well as staff has also been attending the forums that were led by HR. And I want people to keep in mind that we still are a part of Newcastle County government, and a lot of our policies and procedures still has to go through the HR process. So if you would hold your questions or talk to Mike at any time, but right now I'm looking at the clock and we are encroaching on the time of the Public Safety Committee meeting. I do want to give Nelly a few minutes to briefly talk about the protocols as we plan this phase reentry. And I want to have a few minutes left so we can talk about the protests that are going on in America today. So if I can get the cooperation of council members and staff to any questions you may have regarding the presentation by council to council, if you can reach out to him, but I don't want to not have an opportunity to get to Nelly and then to have some commentary around the protest that's going on in America. And then we'll complete the agenda for today and at least we won't encroach into the next meeting any more than a half an hour. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you.
So now if Nellie is prepared to talk briefly about the protocols that we were planning to use as we phase back into the office.
Sure, and I'll be as quick as possible. So everyone got the emails that HR and risk management sent out. Our thinking is we would just follow the guidelines that they've set forward. So people entering our building, they are having their temperature screened. If for some reason they have a fever, they would then be instructed to go outside and call risk management. And then they'll run through the list of questions and deem whether or not that they're fit to then come to work or if any further follow-up needs to be done with their medical professionals. Our thinking is they have the staff and the ability to handle that. And it makes the most sense to just let them do that and follow the protocols that everyone in the county is following. Everyone in county buildings must wear a mask when they are within 6 feet of another person, so and in common areas. So we've secured disposable masks and cloth masks for everybody. They did come in, we have them in the office. So we'll be asking staff to wear those when they're not in their offices and when they're in the presence of another person. They obviously can also wear masks that they have from home, but we did want to have those available. Everyone obviously will be screened, temperature screened. We did get a temperature gun. The city is looking into doing the thermal scanners so that people coming through security would be scanned at that point. But we will have the gun on our floor should we need to use that to take temperatures. We've secured hand sanitizer for everyone to keep in their office. We've secured automatic hand sanitizer stations to place throughout the office when you walk in from a high touch area like the doors and in the kitchen and by the copiers. Again, they're automatic so that we don't have to have anyone touching those. We've secured an automatic soap dispenser for the kitchen for hand washing along with an automatic paper towel dispenser. Again, trying to limit the amount of surfaces that people have to touch throughout the day that are shared in common. So these are the types of things that we've done. And we've also secured gloves. There was a request to have those. So the thinking was whenever council staff is back in the office, that these are some of the things that would be in place just per CDC guidelines. And then obviously it's up to council when that would occur, but we will be ready when we're back in the office.
Thank you very much, Nellie. I just want to let council members know as well as staff that Nellie has the authority to provide whatever's out there. There's no limitations in terms of what Nellie may identify as something that will offer more protection. I know Nellie, when Nellie and I talked, she talked about additional hand washing stations. So Nellie has begun, as you all know, with some of the PPE equipment probably a couple of months ago. So Nellie is continuing to see what's available and aggressively going out after that to try to make certain that's in our office available to us. And we'll also have the administration's equipment and so forth available to us as part of the county council. So I think that if there are further questions and comments for Nellie, she's available to all of us. I do want to thank you, Nellie. I do want to have a couple of minutes to talk about something that's troubling to me that's going on, not only in America, but across the globe now. And it certainly impacts those of us in Newcastle County, in my personal opinion. So, Nellie, I want to thank you. And I'll move on to the next item on the agenda, which is the protest in America. And what I would like to say is that so bear with me, I have put together a minute or so of prepared statements. As I've thought about this, after viewing what we've all been seeing over the last couple of weeks, and it's very troubling to me, as I know it is to some others as well. But the protests that we're seeing, in my opinion, is just a symptom of a much, much bigger problem that we have in America. The fact is that police brutality is generational in the Black community. My grandmother warned me about it. She frequently talked to me about the police. And today I talked to my grandson about being the target of rogue police officers. what I've learned in the last several months or so is that police brutality is a leading cause of death for young black men in America. Just a few months ago, I got rid of the car I was driving and I got another car. And I decided to give the car I was driving to my grandson, who's in school out of town. And when I gave the car to my grandson, my daughter, his mother, was really troubled and bothered. She just assumed that with him being away and driving the car that I had driven, that he would attract a lot of negative attention to himself from the police. It bothered me because I felt like, well, it's my car, I've driven it for all these years. Why wouldn't I want to give it to my grandson? Why would it create this much concern for my daughter and for me as well? The one thing I know, and everyone talks about quite a bit, is that the job of police officers is a stressful one. But I also know that being black in America is also stressful. And the difference between being black in America and police officers is the fact that if you're black in America, you don't get days off to recuperate from your stress. If you're black in America, you don't retire from your blackness when you get to be 55 years old. So I don't have the luxury to stay muted. Police terror is constant in the black community. We cannot claim that George Floyd was a sacrificial lamb until we see change. I stand with the protesters around the world for change. Only then will we know that the lynching of George Floyd has moved the conscience of America and the will of elected officials. I'm reminded of Officer Thomas Webster from the Dover Police Department, who responded to a call to a fight in progress. And when it arrived, he identified Latif Dickerson as one of the participants in the fight. He commanded that Latif fall to the ground. Latif followed the demand with his hands in the air, fell to the ground. Falling to the ground, Officer Webster decided to kick him in the head with, I guess, all the force he had. He broke his jaw, caused serious trauma to his head. The chief's cap flew off. And it bothered me when I realized, reading the paper, that obviously the FOP was defending the officer. I also realized that the head of the FOP at the time was Captain Fred Calhoun. Captain Fred Calhoun is on the Newcastle County Police Department. So it bothered me to the point I talked to the county executive and I talked to the chief of police, Elmer Setting, at the time. So I had a meeting with Captain Calhoun. He came to my office. And what the captain told me was that he was just doing his job to represent the officer from Dover, Thomas Webster. And he said we would just have to agree to disagree. And that what Officer Webster did was what they learned in training. And the other reason why it troubled me so much, because being a captain in the Newcastle County Police Department, you're eligible to be the chief. And for me to have someone with that mindset to think about being the chief of police in Newcastle County was just very troubling to me. So the Officer Webster from Dover, finally he was found, he was let go in Delaware for reasons you probably all know. But there was a payout, taxpayers paid him out, then he got a job in Greensboro, Maryland. He got to Greensboro, Maryland, and the NAACP begged the city not to hire him. They hired him anyway. And after a short period of time on the job in Greensboro, Officer Webster apprehended a young black man, 19 years old, handcuffed him. And while being handcuffed, he died. The state of Maryland investigated and found out that the hiring of Officer Webster did not follow Maryland's procedures, and that Officer Webster had not revealed the fact that while he was in Dover, He had 30 complaints against him of unnecessary use of force. So I don't know where he is now. He'll probably end up in another police department somewhere. But I'll just say one other incident, and I'll be quiet. But in September of 2015, Wilmington police shot and killed Jeremy McDowell. He was in a wheelchair. And the Attorney General concluded that the criminal prosecution of a police officer for the use of deadly force under existing Delaware law is extremely challenging. Extremely challenging. And I compliment the Attorney General, Matt Dinn, for going to the extent that he did to try to bring justice. He brought in national people that had involved in investigating the murder of Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old in Cleveland that had been killed by police. And he was told that the Delaware law, it was unlikely he would get a conviction. But Matt Dinn didn't stop there. He brought in another national known investigator. And the conclusion was the same thing. Delaware has what is called the Policeman's Bill of Rights, which is essentially a ticket to allow the police to abuse with the confidence that they're going to get off. So one of the police officers in that case last year shot an 18-year-old black man, young boy in Wilmington. After he shot him, he altered his barrel against police protection, but he's still on the Wilmington police force. Now the shooting that occurred with the four police officers that killed Bam Bam, it was another settlement because you couldn't get a conviction even there. And Matt Dinn made it very clear why you could not get a conviction. So there was $1.5 million payout of taxpayer money because of these officers. And it continues to go on and on and on while people are suffering. These officers are costing the taxpayers a tremendous amount of money, and they're going on like nothing ever happened. It's very unlikely for any change to come from Dover. The Delaware General Assembly has become a retired police community. But I believe this is a defining moment for every elected official in the state of Delaware. And I just wanted to get something out. Other council members may or may not want to chime in. Like I said earlier, I cannot remain muted, and I don't plan to remain muted during this process and during this quest for change. So I just want to put that out there, and I apologize that we didn't have as much time as I would like to have had. And I know that the public safety co-chairs are pretty much eager to get started. We've taken up about 25 minutes of their time, but I would like to give other members of council or comment an opportunity to comment, and then we will move on in adjournment. And the next meeting is supposed to start at 5. Obviously, it's not going to start at 5 o'clock. Supposed to start at 4. So that's my comments. Any other comment from any other person, please? Councilman Street is identified to speak. Councilman?
Well, I'm going to be real brief because I have some other things to say about it. I do want to get to public safety. But not last year, not when that boy got kicked in the head, but as a nation, are protesting and demanding reform in the police departments all across the country. As the state is demanding reform in police agencies throughout the state, as people are protesting in our county, in our city, and demanding reform, today, the same person you mentioned, a Newcastle County police officer, president of the state FOP, is the one, according to what's in the Delaware public media, already leading the fight against a police civilian review board. So as much as some things change, some things, some people, and some attitudes will never change.
Thank you, Councilman Street. Is there any other comment from any other member of council? Seeing none,
Councilman Hall.
Councilman Carter.
I'd like to.
Councilman Carter.
I really appreciate your comments. You know, I've been out listening as much as I could. I've made it to three of those protests with the idea of listening and lifting up. There is no doubt that we need to make some significant changes and reforms. I think we need to look across the board. I know it's a lot of commotion. It's a lot of stress out there. And it's our job to make sense out of that and make it lead to constructive change for the public good. You know, we don't see any major political change in this country, in this state, in this county, without some social commotion and some energy. And we have to harness that. I think it would be a real disservice for us not to all be listening really hard, looking what we have that's working, looking what we have to build up on in our police force as well as others. You know, we're all getting the emails about defunding the police. You know, when we decipher that, that's really looking at making changes that improve it. I don't know, maybe some people do want to get rid of it, but it's not at all that. And there's a lot that we need to look at. And it goes, for me, the police one is one that we have to address right away, both for the good of the citizens and also for the good of our police force. They need to restore the trust and credibility, and they need our help to do that. So I hope we will take a good look at this. I would love us to do a more thorough audit, a broad audit of many of our policies, at least the law enforcement policies, but also some of our land use policies and some of our other policies. I think we need that audit, and we should come together and think about what a constructive agenda could look like to make sure that we are fairly and equally serving everybody in this county. You know, so I really appreciate Councilman Holland, your comments, the detailed data you have given, and I really hope that we can work together and think about some really constructive changes to capitalize on this policy moment while it's here. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman Carter. We will continue. It's not over. We may be a minority in this effort, but we will continue. Councilwoman Durham would like to add a comment.
Thank you so much. Following up on what Dave Carter said, I just wanted to say that I know obviously all of you are receiving the same hundreds of emails that I'm getting as well about defunding the police. And as Dave said, that's not necessarily literally what it means, but I hope that we can move forward. Obviously, I've been trying to find out where those messages are coming from so that I can speak to the organization about clarifying their message, because obviously they're confusing city council with county council, but nevertheless, the message is there for us. And I think we need to, instead of being dismissive of all those emails, I hope we can look further into what they're asking us to do, even though, yes, we already passed our budget last week. The conversation can start now about how we can incorporate some of the things they're asking for and have those conversations moving forward.
Thank you, Councilwoman. I did receive those emails, as all of council members did, I believe. And I have responded to a number of those young people, and I have also spoken to a number of them. I don't know exactly why they had us as county council members when they were primarily discussing an issue in Wilmington. As I explained to those kids, every elected official should be held accountable, even though the target may be the police, but it's elected officials who decide who's going to be the police chief of every jurisdiction, whether it's the governor, whether it is the mayor, or it's the county executive. We as legislators approve those budgets, so we're all held accountable. If we're going to look the other way and allow this nonsense to continue, then obviously people like myself will be looking to take some other action, and I appreciate your support. But those young people, and I know at the rally that was held downtown Wilmington, the last one, there was over 1,000 people, and you probably couldn't find 20 people there.
that was over 30 years old. So there's a young group of people from all over Newcastle County, that are responding to us, telling us to do something about this. So I appreciate your comments. Councilman Cartier.
Thank you, Councilman Hollins. I too applaud you for your statement of truth about having ending police brutality in the United States. I'm impressed by watching all of the things unfold around the George Floyd murder, how this has become a global movement all over the world. People are energized in this moment. And I received a lot of these emails we were just discussing, one of which was very compelling to me. It was the gentleman addressing the NAACP proposals regarding police reform. I immediately carbon copied the county executive and the Colonel Bond of the Newcastle County Police. I think that's a good area for exploration for reforming and improving our police practices. I think we have a good police force, but we can always do better. And then also, I'm impressed by a model that's been in the media of a metro policing reform that happened with Camden and the adjacent county, which seems to have produced measurably better community policing for the city of Camden. So I, in this moment, share your horror and concern, and I have an open mind about what we can do to improve our community policing model. And as I said, I think we have a very good police department, perhaps the best in the state, but we can always look at areas of improvement.
Thank you, Councilman Cartier, for your comments. And there are good police officers all over. Unfortunately, there are police officers that are not, they're evil. And we often hear that 90% of the police are good people. And that could very well be true, but the math doesn't work for me when I see four police officers murder a person that's unarmed and on the ground. So something about those numbers is not ringing true to me. I hope that's the case. But if 95% of the police officers are so great, then what's so hard about purging the five that's not so great? Some folk talk about peace, the peaceful protests, and they get hijacked. Sometimes they do. But I think what people are looking for is a peaceful police force. It goes both ways, and it's really difficult to continue offering peace when your oppressor has his knee on your neck and your oppressor doesn't have a conscience. Councilwoman Karen Hartley-Nagel would also like to speak.
Yes, Council President speaking. I just wanted to let you know that I've spoke to a number of the individuals that contacted me by email, and also one of the organizers a few days ago. And we're setting up a forum that'll probably take place Thursday or Friday. The details probably hopefully be solidified by today or tomorrow, hopefully at the latest. And so we can have six from council that can participate, as well as the police chief, the county executive, and potentially some members of city council. So that is a forum that they would like to have. It'll take place by Zoom. And I will, as soon as the details are finalized, I'll let everybody know.
Thank you, Councilwoman Hartley-Nagel. I'm sort of in an awkward place right now because we've 36 minutes past the time for the Public Safety Committee meeting to start. And I really think it may be the best thing to do is to move into, I know that we haven't gotten to public comment, but we've run out of time for this committee meeting. The next committee meeting is public safety, quite frankly, where we obviously in public safety, we have a broader discussion about police and public safety initiatives. So I would ask the public who's there to forgive me and all of us for not having the time to engage questions. But I would encourage you at the same time to stay tuned for the Public Safety Committee meeting that's coming up next. And at the conclusion of that meeting and during that meeting, as a matter of fact, on each agenda item, you would have the opportunity to speak. So I think in to represent fairness, I probably should not monopolize any more time of the Public Safety Committee meeting. So.
Motion to adjourn.
Councilman Smiley.
You looking for a motion to adjourn?
Yes, sir.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Meeting is adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Problem set.